You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 24th of July, 2024, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, and a review of some of the news emerging from the UK construction industry over the past couple of weeks. And I suppose we could talk at length, Phil, about, what the new Labour government is doing or says it will do that will impact the industry, but maybe we've had enough politics for the time being and we'll wait until we actually see some results and then talk about it.
Well, we've had the King's Speech, so we sort of know a bit. But yeah, I'm kind of temporarily, enough politics. I think people want to hear something else from us.
I've noticed one U-turn already, though. I heard on the radio that Angela Rayner's going to do a U-turn on the nutrient neutrality rules. You know, she called Michael Gove reckless for proposing a relaxation of the rules, and now it looks like they're going to do it anyway. So that would be one worth watching, I think.
No, I'm sure what Angela Rayner's going to do will be completely different to what Michael Gove's going to do. There'll be a comma in a different place.
Yeah, that's true. So what should we talk about? We got a story of yours that has moved on a little bit. So shall we update that a bit for our listeners?
Well, yeah, we talked last time, a couple of weeks ago, when we were last together, David, about AdBlue and the problems that people were having, and how the European Train and Heavy Transport Association, ESTA, were doing a questionnaire to try and find out the extent of problems that people are having with AdBlue. And since I ran that, lots of people have been in touch to say, AdBlue, dreadful stuff, I hate it. And we said, could people, get in touch, tell us their experiences? And more people have said, oh, yes, hate it, dreadful. However, a couple of people have got in touch to tell us about products which I had never heard of. One is Effinox and one is OptiSpray. And these are alternatives to AdBlue. And I'm not in any way recommending them. I have no expertise. So do your own homework. But I just feel that if lots of people are having problems with AdBlue, maybe lots of people don't know that there are alternatives. And briefly, this is what I'm told. OptiSpray is AdBlue with a surfactant. Is that how you pronounce that word? Surfactant?
I believe so.
Added, and that changes the surface tension of AdBlue, allowing it to hydrolyze at lower temperatures. And it prevents the build-up of those white spots, the cyanuric acids. That's one product. Effinox is an AdBlue with a reagent added, which, according to Effinox people, it not only prevents the build-up of the deposits, but it removes the deposits that you've already got. It has a cleaning agent as well as a prophylactic. So thank you to Chris Haynes, Managing Director of Green Chem Solutions, and to the people who produce OptiSpray as well for getting in touch and explaining all this to us. And I'm sure there are other products out there. So if you're suffering with AdBlue, it sounds like you don't need to.
But I noticed actually, Phil, that maybe it's so long ago that you'd forgotten about it, but you actually ran a story about the problems with AdBlue as long ago as 2017. Do you remember that?
I do not.
No, well, what let did me I remind say? You. It was in, it, actually, it was a professor at your old alma mater, Loughborough University, Professor Graham Hargrave, who's a specialist in internal combustion engines, I believe. They've been working on a solution to the problems of AdBlue, which are clearly well known even back then. Their technology is something they call ACCT, ammonia creation and conversion technology. It just enables the AdBlue to work at lower temperatures. They reckon, in fact, I've got a quote here, our system enables the SCR systems, that's the selective catalytic reduction system, which is in diesel engines. It enables the SCR systems to work at much lower temperatures, as low as 60 degrees centigrade. This means that the nitrous oxide reduction system remains active throughout the whole real-world driving cycle, leading to significant reductions in tailpipe emissions. And I mean, the problem, as you laid out in your recent stories, is that basically the AdBlue doesn't really work until engines get up to a certain temperature. And they sometimes don't do that if they're being,
Construction machinery stop starting. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you get problems with this buildup of deposits and stuff like that. So I think it's probably worth following up on this and maybe speaking to Professor Hargrave and people like GreenChem and the producers of Optis spray to find out whether or not it's actually Professor Hargrave's technology that they've adopted and commercialized and used to produce their products. It might not be, but it might be. I think probably there's more to say on this topic. So an interesting one to follow up, I think.
Well remembered you, or did you Google it?
I Googled it, of course. No, I didn't Google it. I looked through our archive, Phil.
Yes. So it's a good place to look.
I knew there'd be some gems hidden away there somewhere.
The main thing I want to talk about today is, and this is something which those who have read the July edition of the Construction Index magazine, it's the lead news story, which it's not really news, it's more of a sort of a news analysis roundup of all the mergers and acquisitions activity that's been going on this year. Now, obviously, the construction industry in the UK has got zillions of companies, and there's always companies starting, disappearing, being sold, taking over, merging, etc. But it seems to me that there is more active, and I've got no stats to back this up, but my feeling is there's been more merger and acquisition activity this year than usual. I won't say than ever, begin to say that, but than usual. A lot of big deals going down, and not so big, but interesting deals. And it could be that we've talked before about COVID, all these the government loans kept fragile companies going, and when that regime finished and it's time to get back into the real world again, they became a bit wobbly or wobblier. It could be that there's an element of growth market and a lot of return to optimism in the economy, and therefore people are looking for, right, we should be in growth mode now, what do we do? And just run over a few of them. The latest one is a story that we posted yesterday, which, if I just call it up in front of me, which is Urban and Civic taking over L&Q Estates. These are the sort of master developer companies. And this is driven by, well, two things. L&Q wanted to, as a housing association, wanted to focus on their existing properties rather than being a master developer. And Urban and Civic is masses of house building promised by the new government and wanting to do lots more land assembly and master developing. So that's quite an interesting coming together. And then not so long ago, probably even bigger, if it happens, is Bellway want to take over Crest Nicholson. Have we talked about this before, the Crest Nicholson?
I don't think we've talked about it on the podcast. No, I mean it's been sort of on and off, hasn't it, for several months now.
Well,
it seems to be on now.
Well, Bellway made two approaches for Crest Nicholson within the past few months, both of which the Bellway board said no, not interested. And then Avant Homes, the outfit run by and significantly owned by our old friend Jeff Fairburn from Ex Persimmon, the man with very heavy and full pockets. and the Bellway board, the Crest Nicholson board said no to Avant, not interested in you, because we've still got Bellway sniffing around us. And Bellway have come back with a new offer, which is ostensibly lower than Avant's offer, but Crest Nicholson board is saying, no, we think a tie-up with you does work in concept, so we'll talk to you. So now the Bellway Board has until, I haven't got the date in front of me, something like the 5th of August, they've got a few weeks to come up with a firm offer, right. to formalise it, to actually, to go public and formalise everything. And that looks like it's happening. Whether other bids emerge, whether Avant ups its bid and other people come forward, we don't know. And as I wrote in the news piece for the magazine, we've also got Carla Holmes, another big house builder, part of Legal & General. That's on the block. That's up for sale with various speculation about who might be buying it. And, of course, we've had Redrow and Barratt agreed last month to hook up. I think that's effectively a takeover of Redrow by Barratt. I think it's that way around, but it's very much a merger. And there have been all sorts of other deals, I mean, across the industry. Tommy Clark, T. Clark, the building services contractor, has been delisted from the London Stock Exchange and has been taken over by Regent Gas, which is looking to expand and diversify. Renew, the engineering services group, has made a couple of acquisitions. A bridge maintenance specialist, Route 1, and Excalon Holdings, who are in the electricity transmission and distribution market. Also in the utility sector, OCU Group, which used to be O'Connor Utilities.
I was going to say, I've never heard of them.
They've been on a bit of an acquisition trail, I think, since their own private equity takeover. And their latest is RJ McLeod, who's got a Scottish civil engineering contractor, has got quite a bit of work laying power cables to connect wind farms to the grid.
Yeah, big growth area.
And there's masses of them. In the materials world, Heidelberg Materials, what used to be Hansen UK, has bought up a soil and aggregate recycling company, B&A Group. And it also, last year, I think it's only completed this year, but it's been in the work for a while, Mick George.
Yes.
And it's trying to widen its exposure to the whole world of recycling rather than a virgin product that its core business is. Holcim's UK business, Aggregate Industries, has acquired Land Recovery, a supplier of recycled construction materials.
Holcim's a German company, isn't it?
Swiss.
Okay.
Other materials, Breeden acquiring Phoenix Surfacing. It's that's more for its contracting business that Breeden also has. We may have mentioned Sigma Rock taking over the UK lime operations of CRH. Mm-hmm. Building maintenance sector. We've got this new name on the block, Cardo, which started off by, was sort of created out of LCB Group and Osborne Property Services, the maintenance arm of Geoffrey Osborne, and Geoffrey's contractors. And they've recently bought Cardiff-based A&N Lewis, not a company I've ever heard of, but here's a company which is sort of a new creation, acquiring to build itself up. Who have I missed out? I don't know.
You mentioned Perry taking over Maybe Hire. That was an interesting one.
Yeah, that's another one.
Because both family companies, I think, aren't they? Certainly Maybe was. I think Perry might be.
I think it's been a while since Maybe. Don't hold me to this. I don't think Maybe's been a family country for a few years.
Oh, really? Okay.
I may be wrong. And also the different bits of Maybe. Maybe sort of split up a few years
ago.
Specifically Maybe Hire as well, than Maybe Bridge or whatever it is. I haven't even mentioned our friends RKS, is that what they're called?
In the past. That's because they're at it all the time.
They're always at it.
It's not really news when they take over another company. But the house building, I mean, obviously the biggest mergers and acquisitions seem to be in the house building sector at the moment, which of course is a sector which is poised for action now that we've got a Labour government that's going to build. But
they say that the Labour government isn't going to build anything.
Well, I know that, but that's what they mean is
say yes to all the planning, just overrule all the planning objectives. Yes,
of course. But I mean, what do the authorities, the merger and acquisitions authorities, say about these mergers. I mean, I'm sure they must be running the rule over them. You can't have massive house builders like this consolidating the sector without some scrutiny.
That is a very good question. I think there will be scrutiny. It'd be interesting to see, but it would make sense for them to do them all at once if and when we do have Carla, Crest Nicholson, Redrow, or I think they disappear. I mean, Redrow is not going to disappear. Crest Nicholson is not going to be disappear.
No, they'll still be a brand.
The brands will be kept as another brand. I mean, Barrett has already got David Wilson as a brand, so it would just be three brands. But yeah, the what do they call CMA, Competition and Markets Authority?
Yeah,
I have no doubt they will be
all over
very interested. But having said that, if the Labour government want to promote house building, they shouldn't stand in the way of the market. And if the market, i.e., the shareholders of these companies, want to come together to make themselves more powerful, better able to deliver these 250 million houses, then, or homes, I should say, most of them will be flats in tower blocks, then get out of the way, government, let them do it, I guess.
Well, I suppose so, although that sounds more like a sort of a Tory approach, if you ask me. You know, let the market decide. But the Tory government, the last Tory government, certainly, I don't know if it actually did anything to achieve this, but it was talking a lot about giving more power or encouraging SME house builders. Because one of the problems they felt was that locally houses weren't being built because land was held in massive land banks by the big six or big four, however many there are now, and they weren't building them out quickly enough, and that they should, if they had local small to medium sized house builders in the market on a local basis, more houses would get built, more jobs would be created, and more people would be able to afford homes, which I would have thought was probably, I don't know, maybe that's a free market approach as well. But I wouldn't have expected the Labour government to give the big PLCs a free hand.
Well, they're talking as if they're going to. And but you mentioned the SME bill. Certainly, my perspective is that the small developments of whether it's sort of, you know, 4 to 12 houses that go up, I mean, there are a couple within a mile, in fact, 3 or 4 within a mile of me I can think of, which are beautifully done in traditional materials, I should say, beautiful stone houses, very well done and look great. And I would, certainly somewhere I'd very much would appeal to me if I was looking to buy a house. I go, yeah, they look lovely little development. Yeah. I'd buy there. And contrast that with the huge, great, ticky-tacky rabbit hutches that have been splashed up in huge, great numbers. And I think, well, certainly wouldn't want to live in that sort of soulless.
But then you see the big volume. That's what the big volume house builders build. You don't. They won't build those lovely. No.
But the lovely little ones enhancing. So the SME builders are enhancing the built environment in the local area, and the big companies, to my mind, are okay. We all need houses. I accept that, but their developments are not making anywhere look better on the whole.
No,
although
that's true.
There are a few, there are occasional exceptions. I'm trying to think. I think the Redrow development near me, which does look, you know, I think it's a mill building that's been converted or something, and that does look good. And then right next to it, someone's put up an absolutely monstrous red block, and you think, oh, what a shame! Someone's done something right and well there, and the local planners have let someone put up a carbuncle next to it. So it's not. The big national builders, they can do it right, but they don't often.
Well, getting back to the question of this apparent increase in merger and acquisition activity in the market, Phil, have you got any theory about why things are hotting up, why there's more activity now?
Yeah, well, I mean, not a huge one, but as I said in my introduction, I think it's the fact that the economy is on the turn. people who have got some, in house building, it's a quick way to get land. It's hard to buy land. Yeah. And if someone's got land and needs help to build it out, take over the whole company. What you're taking over is their land bank. You're not, you know, Barrett's acquiring Redrow and Bellway wants Cress Nicholson, not because it's full of great bricklayers and super people. Well, it might be perfectly good people.
Doesn't employ bricklayers.
But it's, yeah, exactly. The motive is it's land, it's assets.
Yeah.
Talking about running companies and what company bosses are doing and how they think, I was very interested to hear from Travis Perkins. When was this? It's a fortnight. It was just after we last spoke. I think it was the day after we last spoke, Dave. It was 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
We'd already reported that it was back in March, at the end of March, that Travis Perkins' chief executive, Nick Roberts, stepped down after 5 years in the role fairly suddenly. And I think they just issued a profits warning or something, or their results had been shortly after their profits had fallen and things are a little bit sticky. And mm-hmm. so he went, and 3 months later, 4 months later, March, April, May, June, July, 4 months later, lo and behold, who should be named as the new chief executive of Travis Perkins, a builders merchant group primarily, but Pete Redfern, the former chief executive of Taylor Wimpey. And I thought, well, that's quite a coup. Pete Redfern, he's always a bit like Adrian Ringrose at Interserve. He got to the top, a top job at really quite a young age, and left at a young age. And thought, okay, well now where's it?
Now
I have no idea
do?
what it's been doing for the past few years. When did he? I've just got it. When did he leave?
He left in 2021.
2021. So he's I don't know whether he's been running other companies for three years, or he's been, you know, water skiing holiday, around the Caribbean or whatever. but he had a very strong reputation at Taylor Wimpey. I mean, when he first arrived there, it was. It was pretty ropey. He took over as chief executive in 2007 when he was in his 30s or something. And in the next couple of years, they lost sort of 700 million and then lost 70 million in 2009, 2010. But after that, that was obviously the financial crash, he just arrived at a difficult moment. But in his last 10 years, Taylor Wimpey shareholders banked more than £5 billion in pre-tax profit, averaging £500 million a year. I mean, most of the house builders were making splendidly disgusting huge profits at this time. But Taylor Wimpey was one of the good ones. And I think it was the Labour Party that tapped up Pete Redfern to do a study of the housing market and sort of advise them on what
it was Corbyn. It was Jeremy Corbyn who got him
was
to do
it?
That.
Ooh.
Yeah.
so he's a person of good pedigree. And also interesting is that at the same time as announcing Pete Redfern as their new chief executive. He starts in August, 16th of September he starts. So he can still do a bit more water skiing during August and then get into it. they're getting a new chair as well. Sorry, folks, I nearly said chairman. How dare I? And the new chair is the former chief executive of Ashtead Group, which older people might know of as the parent company of what used to be A-Plant and is now Sunbelt hire company. So he's another. That's Jeff Jabble. So he's another familiar name to the construction industry. All this makes me think of all sorts of things I want to talk about around this. And it's on the one hand, I think Travis Perkins have. It almost becomes a buy recommendation. If you've got these two people there, you think, oh, that's a good team they've got there.
Yes, absolutely.
Those are strong appointments. It's a bit like you're getting, Mourinho and Alex Ferguson in one hit kind of thing. That's a football reference, David. Sorry to look
I recognise the names. I'm sure that was a recommendation.
But on the other hand, I can't help thinking that Travis Perkins, companies of that size ought to have succession strategies, and they ought to be promoting from within. And while I understand there are times when you think, oh, no, we need a clean boom, we need a fresh look at things, we need to start again, things should never get so bad in the first place where you need to have a revolution. It should be evolution. You can always change, but it should be incremental, and I think. Maybe, you know, COVID or, you know, catastrophic events that can happen, market crashes.
Yeah.
And, you know, things can change and you need to have a revolution because of outside events. But in general terms, I would have a higher regard for a company that brought its players up through the academy rather than went out and signed a superstar from Argentina or Brazil kind of thing.
But didn't you say, Phil, that Travis Perkins has had a pretty rough time? It has, you know, has it been making losses? Has it had difficulty running the business?
Reduced profits is all. Okay. But
nothing disastrous?
I don't know. I don't think so. But it was interesting that Travis Perkins, it's previous. The guy that Pete Redfern is replacing, Nick Roberts. I mean, Pete Redfern is coming from house building to, as I said, I don't know what he's been doing for the past 3 years. It might not be water skiing. But it's going from house building to whatever, into Travis Perkins, which is, say, primarily builders merchants, but it does a bit of tool hire and other stuff. And the predecessor was Nick Roberts, who came from the consulting engineer W.S. Atkins, as was. So that was quite a left-field turn for Nick Roberts and for Travis Perkins. So who do we want to run our, essentially, you know, retail service business? Oh, let's get a consulting engineer.
Consulting engineer, yes.
Which is a left-field turn. Whereas previously, they had promoted from within. The guy before Nick Roberts was John Carter. Also only did 5 years in the top job. He'd been with Travis Perkins for 25 years before he became chief executive. Now that, I don't know if it's sentimental or whether it's good business practice. I just like the idea of someone who's grown up the business, they embody the culture of the business, rises to the top, and you know that it just tells the company, all the junior, middle management, even senior management, do a good job, you too can get to the top. And if you just keep bringing in someone from outside, you're basically saying to all your middle management and your anyone with any ambition in the company,
you ain't going anywhere.
You might, if you want to get to the top, start leaving. You know, think about leaving. Brush up your CV.
Yeah.
Now the other thing, on related to this topic, whether it's an outsider or an internal candidate, often when you see an internal candidate take over as chief executive, it's often the finance director. Because if a chief executive either fails or gets run over by a bus or gets poached, a better offer somewhere else, or you know, suddenly goes, the person in the chair nearest to the chief executive is deemed to be the best person. And if there's any sort of difficulty the company's in, it's like, oh, get the finance person to sort it out. They're a nice analytical, rational head. And there used to be a kind of I don't know if trope's the right word, but a perspective that companies in retrenchment mode get a finance person to run it, and companies in growth mode get a sort of a sales and marketing person, business development type person, to, you know, someone more gung-ho and outward looking to do it. I'm not sure what truth there is in that, but that
sounds logical though.
But what's interesting is that while he has not been their finance director, Pete Redfern is an accountant by background. His first job in the construction industry in the 1990s was finance director at Rugby Cement.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I think he before Taylor Wimpey, I think he was on the finance side at George Wimpey before becoming their chief executive. And again, instinctively, rather like I don't like I prefer to see companies promote from within than recruit from outside for the top job. Whenever they put the finance director in the top job, I would think, oh, that just seems a bit, because the finance director tend to come with the culture of a Price Waterhouse or Arthur Andersen or wherever they did their training and qualified, rather than the culture of the company where they're working. But there are notable exceptions and interesting exceptions. Rob Perrin at Barclays, Barclay Group, he at quite a young age was the finance director. He was Tony Pidgett's protege, basically, and two contrasting people you couldn't think of. Rob Perrin's a good public schoolboy, and Tony Pidgett is from gypsy stock, orphan or brought up by gypsies, or very humble background, entrepreneur, great stuff. And Rob Perrin became his protege, his financial director, and has been chief executive of Barclays for getting on a decade now, maybe. I'm not sure that my numbers are quite right there, but well established, and has been with the company for yonks. So there's a case for financial director. Maybe it's something about house building where the financial directors are a better fit than, say, in a retail operation or something like that.
Okay.
But the other financial director that was promoted to the top seat was David Allen of Waits, or ex of Waits. David Allen was the finance director at Waits, or chief finance officer, or whatever they call him, but essentially the top finance guy at Waits. And then he was made chief executive of Waits. And then I don't quite know how much of this is his decision, other people's decision, but now he moved in December 2022, so whatever that is, 18 months ago, to Mace as chief financial officer. So he went finance, chief exec, back, okay, I'm going to say it, down to financial officer Waits to Mace. So I think he did a reasonable job at Waits. I've no idea why he left, frankly, but it seemed to be quite a sudden departure. Where am I going with this?
I've got to say, what's your point, Phil?
my point is, while I am prejudiced against accountants in broad terms, as I think most of us are, because they tend to be the people in an organisation that you can't have a pay rise and you can't spend any money.
Yeah,
they're often the shrewd move to put it in the top job, if not always the most creative and creative.
Yeah. I suppose the thing is, if for example, your finances need tightening up, maybe if your turnover is going up, but your profit margin's going down or something like that, it makes sense to get a numbers man in to find out where things are going wrong. And maybe your finance officer is the right person for that.
But getting the numbers right is the job of the finance person. So if you're a good finance person, stay in your box and look after the numbers box of numbers. The chief executive should have
the vision.
Exactly, the leader, the inspirer, and ever go, oh yeah, I'll follow you over the mountain, and I'll march through walls to work with you and do what you want us to do. And yeah, okay, my prejudice coming out. I don't think accountants are the most inspiring people. But that's an unjustifiable prejudice, and I apologise. Not.
Well, no, I think you might have a point. I certainly think that's probably a popular view, Phil. Whether or not it's the right one, I don't know. Is what I share, I have to say that. Okay, that succession sorted out. What are we going to move on to? There's another follow-up to a previous story, it's a different aspect to a previous story that we've discussed on the podcast recently. In fact, I think in the last podcast, footbridges, there's some news on footbridges this week, isn't there?
Yes, last week this was, I think. This is National Highways, specifically the Lower Thames Crossing Project, which seems to operate as an entity in its own right, rather like HS2 appears to be. HS2 Limited is an entity. I don't know if there's a Lower Thames Crossing Limited, but it has its own, let's say, its own team, operates in its own office, own identity within National Highways.
For a mega project that doesn't actually exist yet, it's very influential.
Yes. This is going to be a real tester. I think this and the Stonehenge Tunnel, just going back to what we're not talking about, which is politics, but the Labour government say they're going to say yes to everything. If they say yes to the Lower Thames Crossing in Stonehenge, then they are serious about concreting over the countryside, frankly. having said that, I'm in favour of both these projects, and I'm not in favour of concreting over the countryside, so they won't lose my vote. Anyway, Lower Thames Crossing project, as part of the being a pathfinder, a trailblazer in all kinds of things, we've talked before about how they're going to be a net zero carbon.
That's right, yeah.
Have all electric machines.
Hydrogen fueled? Or except, electric, yeah, something like that.
Except they're still going to be buying gazillions of gallons of diesel, litres of diesel we've established, because they can't entirely erase diesel, but they'll just have to plant loads of trees to compensate for it.
That would do it.
Anyway, as part of this pathfinder status that they're adopting for themselves, the Lower Thames Crossing project team is launching, and it opens, I believe, next month, if I remember rightly. They are launching, opens 9th of August, a design competition for a footbridge over the A127, not a road I'm familiar with. A127 intersects with the M25 in Essex, and it's kind of at the top end where the new link roads from the motorways to the Lower Thames Tunnel is being built. This is at the north end of the link roads.
Yeah.
And it's Balfour Beatty that are building the Essex side link roads. Anyway, the top of that. And it's a place where there's not a footbridge at the moment. I think the only reason why they're doing the foot, they feel the need for a footbridge is because they're doing, as part of their mitigation to show how lovely they are doing lots of planting and creating a parkland, but you can't get at it. So they have to build a footbridge so that the local people can get to this little meadow or park or whatever it is that they're planting. It's restoring a connection between two lanes that hasn't existed since 1924, apparently. Wow. So it's the footbridge is in itself seen as an amenity service rather than a replacement.
Yeah.
Anyway,
fair enough.
They want low carbon materials, of course, and low carbon construction methods, good design principles that allows ease of access and a pleasant crossing environment for all pedestrians. So as you're going over, it wants music coming piped out on this bridge going do, 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 as you walk across, be pleasant music.
So, the girl from Ipanema, yeah.
That was meant to be our theme tune, Chetto, I can't sing. Anyway,
you are joking about the pipe music, aren't you, Phil?
It's up to the. I might enter the contest.
I could
enter the competition. It's up to the entrance. But if you want a pleasant crossing environment for all pedestrians,
pipe music is what you need. Yeah,
you got to do something to neutralise the noise. Having said that, not everyone likes pipe music, and they associate it with jukeboxes and drunkards. But anyway. On receiving this press notice from National Highways, I immediately emailed back saying, this is super interesting, actually. As it happens, I am just writing a big article for David Taylor, the editor of Construction Index magazine, for the September issue of Construction Index magazine, about footbridges. Specifically, I'm writing all about Network Rail's footbridges.
Yeah.
And they had a competition. Oh, you and I talked about this 2 weeks ago. Listeners may recall. And I said, they've just published version 2 of their catalogue of footbridges. Please can you tell me why you can't use their catalogue? What are the technical differences between a footbridge over a railway line and a footbridge over a road that mean you need to start the design competition again? As I think I mentioned before, the Network Rail catalogue has got four bridges for in-station environments, which has got lifts on either side, passenger lifts on either side, for Access for All, part of the Access for All initiative. But it also has two bridges, one old, the 400 series, and one new, the Flow, which is low carbon. It's fibre, reinforced polymer, whatever it is. For away from station environments, it hasn't got a lift. It's just a ramp or stairs up one side, a bridge over.
Very sort of sinuous design, yeah, isn't it? Quite attractive.
I illustrated my report of the National Highways design competition with a picture of the first Flow Bridge, which opened in Shropshire in January 2023, whatever that is, 15, 16 months ago.
Mm.
And I think there's another one going in somewhere soon, but I haven't ascertained where yet. No, it may well be it's completely unsuitable, but it just strikes me that you've got two bits of the Department of Transport wanting footbridges. Why don't they talk to each other?
Yeah, that is odd. Well, I suppose it's just a bureaucracy, isn't it? They're siloed. Maybe they don't want to do that.
Well, there could be a perfectly good reason that says, oh, no, if you're going over a road, there's a different technical specification because of ABC. No idea what
it
is.
That and that's the question
I asked. I said, why cannot the rail bridges be used over a road? Or what is wrong with the network rail designs that you don't like? And I dare say there'll be plenty of people who entered the 2018 Network Rail footbridge design competition and will just blow the cobwebs off their design and go, here you go, have a look at this.
Hmm. Is this Lower Thames Crossing Bridge a one-off, or do they want a design that they can roll out across the entire road network?
It may be the latter. I mean, it's initially, the competition is specifically for a bridge for this location to do this job, this place, this time. The aspiration is it will then be a template. The National Highways have not said that they want to do what Network Rail have done and have produced a design manual, but then they don't really need to produce a design manual. The point of the Network Rail design manual is that you've got the five different regions of Network Rail, prone to commissioning architects to design their own little bridge rather than taking one off the shelf. It's a bit like the school building project, and you know, it's criticised in the past for reinventing the wheel every time. And then they've now sort of got these off-the-shelf designs. And although they're still not. Do you remember there's supposed to be an off-the-shelf design for hospitals, a template for hospital buildings? I don't know what ever happened to that.
Yes.
But this is how. But what government is supposed to be doing, saying, these are approved designs, we'll try and keep it up to date, but you don't need to start again at the beginning, start with this, and you'll save yourself a lot of time and money. Now, I suppose if National Highways is the only client, well, that's not true, because local authorities put up their footbridges, so I take that back. Yeah. Maybe National Highways does need to have a catalogue of whether it should, you know, one, five, I don't know how many it would need, footbridges, which are all, you know, to do what Network Rail have done, which can be made available to anyone who needs a footbridge, any highway authority that needs a footbridge.
That would make sense. We've just got a new footbridge over the North Devon Link Road, just down the road from my village, and it's a remarkably large bridge. When I saw the concrete foundations going in for it, I was rather worried about what we were going to get. I mean, it's a footbridge.
Are people in Devon particularly fat?
No comment. But no, it's a.
I think you better.
It's it's all that clotted
cream. You're supposed to say no, not at all.
I'd be lying. But no. no, so we've got this big steel. It's quite an elegant structure, but it is enormous.
Where is it?
It's over the A3. Oh, I can remember. It's 361 North Devon Link Road, and it goes from a village to a field full of cows and there's nothing on the other side. So there's clearly there are going to be some more houses built over there.
Are the cows getting nervous?
Oh, I don't know. They looked fairly relaxed last time I saw them. But no, I mean, suddenly, again, this is a local authority job. It's not a National Highways project. You can't miss it. It's this huge steel bridge. A lot of people are asking questions about it because it doesn't seem to have any purpose. But I'm sure we'll find out in good time.
Well, it can't be to enable the housing. It doesn't enable the housing. And if there was going to be housing there, the housing developers would be, I would have thought, made to put it in as part of the planning conditions.
Well, there so are.
My only guess is that the farmer's holding someone to ransom. Say, I need
possibly.
I need a safe way to get to my cows.
Well, there. I haven't looked at the local authority planning website recently, but I'm pretty sure that there is planning permission for an estate on the other side of the link road there. So. Which is a shame because it's quite a nice bit of, you know, sort of countryside. But people need houses and I'm sure they're going to get them. But they've built the bridge in anticipation, put it that way.
Do you know the footbridges I absolutely hate are the ones where you have to walk about eight times as far to use them.
Up a zigzag, yes.
I'm thinking particularly of this one... at Marsh Mills in Plymouth, I have relations who live in Plymouth and occasionally have to walk from their house to the big Sainsbury's Saver Centre across the... It's a busy sort of 2-3 lane dual carriageway. And there's this footbridge over it, gets you nicely safely to Sainsbury's. But you have to walk round and round. So it's a bit like... queuing it for your passport when you've got the barriers set up and you're going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards. Why can't I just walk straight up? You know, just have the option of some steps. I can just go straight up and say, I mean, I understand need to have.
I was going to say, you wouldn't say that if you were in a wheelchair, Phil.
No, I get that. You can have the ziggy, ziggy, zaggy, zaggy. But honestly, the bridge, the deck, the flat deck crossing must be about 10% of the whole distance that you have to walk to use the damn thing. You get dizzy walking in circles trying to get up there.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe I'll come up with a solution down at the Lower Thames Crossing. We'll have to wait and see about that.
Right. Any other business, David?
I think that's it. Nothing else has really caught my attention this past couple of weeks. I'm sure there'll be more coming out of the new Labour government.
If you want to know more about that Lower Thames Crossing footbridge design competition, by the way, folks, if you want to enter it, and feel free to steal my idea about piped music, because I don't think I'll be getting around to it, and my taste in music is probably not acceptable anyway. So it's nationalhighways.co.uk/LTC footbridge, LTC as in Lower Thames Crossing. Do enter it. Dust off your old Network Rail footbridges and lob them in. Interesting to see what wins.
Okay then, Phil. Are we done?
But we are, David. Thanks again, people, for listening, and we look forward to seeing you again in August. Mm. It's going to be August.
Yeah.
Summer holidays.
Holidays, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. But for another episode of Reconstruction, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.